From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. America is supposed to be the great up-by-the-bootstraps society. Work hard, get ahead. Horatio Alger, the American dream. While minorities and women have made progress breaking into the old boys' club of business and elite jobs, my guest today says the top and bottom of American society remain very sticky. People tend to stay on their rung of the ladder, and that part of the story is about elites hiring elites for America's top jobs. This hour on Point, who gets the top jobs in America and why? You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you tried to fit in to a corporate culture in a job interview? Do privilege, pedigree, legacy matter too much at the top of the U.S. economy? In hiring, join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. With me now from Chicago is Lauren Rivera, author of the new book, Pedigree, How Elite Students Get Elite Jobs. For an excerpt, you can go to our website, onpointradio.org. Lauren Rivera is a professor of management and organizations at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. Lauren Rivera, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So here's your title, Pedigree, How Elite Students Get Elite Jobs. And when I mentioned it to people before the show today, I got this response of, no duh. Like, well, yeah. Like, where do you think that they, you know, they got into great schools and then they get recruited for top jobs. Speak to that just right off the bat response to the framing.
Yeah, definitely. I think that it's a very common process, and it's one that a lot of people understand. But I think in the U.S., we have this notion that somehow if you go to top schools, you are the best and you are the brightest. And people don't realize necessarily that a lot of what it takes to get into these positions of status and prestige have to do not only with if you're intelligent or if you're ambitious, but really what types of resources your parents have to invest in you from a young age. So I think it is a common story that resonates, but the best and the brightest type of narrative is a little bit limited in that it discounts the role that people's upbringing and their class background plays in determining where they fall on the economic ladder.
You look at the moment of hiring. It's what you've gone very, very deep here on, and I want to dive into that. Put it in context for us. Why does this matter? What's the problem, if it is a problem, that you're trying to illuminate by going very deep at looking at how top firms, how and why they hire?
Definitely. So I look at top firms just because of the rising economic inequality that we have in the U.S. We know that over the past several decades, economic inequality has been driven largely by gains at the top. And looking at these jobs, these really are gateways to the 1%. Basically, if you graduate from undergraduate or professional school, you may have very little work experience, but these jobs catapult recent graduates into that top 10% that's been disproportionately driving economic inequality in the U.S. In addition, the jobs tend to pay between 2 to 4 times the other types of employment you can get graduating from the exact same school at the exact same time. So these really are the future 1%ers of the world. So that's why I chose to look at the top. In terms of sociology, we tend to look at inequality and think more of poverty, but looking at inequality at the top is just as important. And with hiring, I chose to study hiring because it's a critical moment of inequality in people's life courses. Basically, your economic status, getting an income, gaining an occupational prestige is contingent upon an employer deciding to hire you. And so these moments have lifelong consequences, not only for your short-term income, but also the types of career opportunities that are available to people later on.
So here you take this hinge point, this hinge moment, and go very deep on it. How do you define elite jobs in your circle of inquiry here?
Yeah, so I'm looking at a very specific type of elite jobs. I'm looking at those entry-level positions, so straight out of undergrad or straight out of professional school in investment banking, management consulting, and law firms. There are lots of other elite jobs that one can have. In the cultural realm, these might look very different, but I chose these jobs because of the high economic stakes. So it's really looking at banking, consulting, and law. And these jobs are they have a lot in common, even though there are differences between them. They've become become almost a credential in their own right for students graduating from elite universities to have on their resumes for a couple of years to open doors to other types of employment and employers. One of the people I interviewed referred to them as finishing school for elite kids who don't know what else to do with their lives. And so they've become a very meaningful type of employment in certain circles.
So elite jobs with a very specific definition here, or a sort of circle around investment banking, consulting firms, and law firms. What about the other side of your equation, elite students? How do you define that?
So I take the perspective of what the employers do. So basically, I don't have an a priori definition of what elite is. I ask them what they think elite is. And to them, they have a much narrower definition that social scientists do, or sociologists. They tend to conceptualize elite very narrowly. So these are top 5, top 10, sometimes top 15 schools. These are based partially on national rankings, but partially just the nation's oldest and most historic campuses, so a lot of the Ivy League schools and so forth.
And what you find is a match there, and that brings us back to the no duh response. I mean, I'm reading here, you're talking about how these things tend to reproduce themselves again and again. You're looking to explain why socioeconomically privileged students tend to get the most elite jobs. Is this really at bottom a critique of elite college admissions, because you're saying that these top firms are taking their graduates, or is it a subset of elite college graduates who you see actually making it over that final hurdle into these top jobs?
So it's the latter. So it's important to note that there's a two-pronged system of inequality happening. The first are that, as you said, class plays a huge role in college admissions and professional school admissions. And it's not only because of pipeline issues in terms of who applies or who the good candidates are. Both universities at the undergraduate and the professional school level have admissions procedures that are systematically biased against students from lower income or less educated backgrounds. So the pool for the employers basically limit consideration to people who go to a very narrow set of schools or those who have a direct personal connection in the firm. And that pool, to begin with, is highly, highly skewed by social class. Then you add on top of that the fact that these employers are using hiring practices that are themselves systematically tilting the playing field even further, that are class biased, and you have a double filter on social class in who gets these jobs. So it's not just universities. Firms are actively screening on top of the filtering that's already done by these colleges and professional schools.
Of course, that's not how they describe what they're up to. I've got a little clip here from a hiring video from J.P. Morgan. Recruiters emphasizing here from J.P. Morgan the aspects of an application that J.P. Morgan recruiters look for, all different kinds of people.
We look for all different types of individuals who can bring new ideas and out-of-the-box thinking to the table, as well as people who've experienced leadership positions through sporting opportunities, as well as through extracurricular activities and society involvement, and people who continuously strive to challenge and develop themselves.
J.P. Morgan describing the range of people they look for. Here's another from Goldman Sachs, a promotional video for Goldman Sachs titled Diversity, talking about the role of diversity in the workplace, how it's a big goal for them.
The diversity ideal comes all the way from the top, and it's something we spend a lot of time in recruiting focusing on. We know that our clients are diverse, and we know that our clients expect us to be diverse as well.
Lauren Rivera, promotional video, so we know it has to be true. is it not?
It is not. So I think that firms in theory think that they are doing their best to diversify both demographically and culturally. And there is at least a publicly stated desire to do so. But you can hear it in those videos. Part of the limitation is that they have a very skewed definition of merit. So the extracurricular piece that was mentioned in that first video, mm-hmm. that we're looking for people who are involved and passionate, they're passionately involved in extracurricular activities and so forth. And
sporting opportunities, people continuously striving to challenge and develop themselves, those sound not bad.
They don't, and they're not bad. That's the thing. A lot of what's happening is under the surface. It's unconscious. But when you look, for example, at the universities from which these firms tend to recruit, and you look at the characteristics of varsity athletes, they actually tend to be some of the most privileged students on campus in terms of their socioeconomic background. Now, that doesn't necessarily correspond with our national myth of sports being the great equalizer and that anyone can just pick up a ball and play. But when you look at the characteristics of varsity athletes at elite universities, you definitely see a pattern, but it points to a broader pattern, which is extracurricular participation in college is strongly segregated and stratified by people's parental socioeconomic status. So if you have to work to pay your tuition bills or to remit payments to family members back home, even if you do go to one of these elite campuses, you don't have the time to passionately invest 30 hours per week in the extracurricular activities of your choosing. And when I talk to people about the resume screening process, if you have to work part-time, that's not particularly glamorous. That's not seen as evidence of passion in some of the things that these firms want. So not all extracurricular activities are treated equal, and those that are seen as more exciting, seen as evidence of passion, leadership, success, are those that require a lot of free time and some disposable income to pursue. I think the other thing that is important is that there's this emphasis on we want people who are different and who have new ideas and new talents and things like that. But if you ask anyone in these industries, why don't you recruit at schools outside of your core and target list? They'll say, well, we could never do that. That's not efficient. So there's a perceived trade-off between diversity and efficiency that I think is also contributing to this.
Do you mean to say that all my time washing dishes to pay my way through college wasn't valuable, didn't pay off for me?
Well, it helps you pay tuition, and there are lots of different activities that can measure things like ambition, drive, dedication, social skills that employers are currently using extracurriculars to measure, and particularly these leisure-oriented extracurriculars. And full-time work can be a great measure of some of these things, but it's something that's not as valued, partially because it's an experience that's foreign to a lot of people who are doing the screening.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point, and we're talking this hour about who gets the top jobs in America and why, looking at the prejudices and networks and systems and talents that influence who ends up at the top. Lauren Rivera is with us. She is a professor at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management and author of the new book, Pedigree, How Elite Students Get Elite Jobs. Americans love the Horatio Alger up by the bootstraps story and keep finding examples of it. This year, 17-year-old New York high school student Harold Akay, an immigrant from Nigeria, African-American, was accepted by all eight Ivy League schools. He eventually chose Yale, spoke to NBC about how America offered his family opportunities, incredible opportunities. Here he is.
I hope I'd inspire students to really achieve higher education, really apply to these great schools, because there's so much to offer. Your opportunities are only limited by how hard you're willing to work.
I've read him, Lauren Rivera, in Chicago, saying this is an unbelievable land of opportunity. And he says, the opportunities are truly limitless. I think what's surprised me the most, how amazing the opportunities really are. And this is a first-generation American. Is this a refutation of your thesis?
No, definitely. In any system of class inequality or economic inequality, there is some mobility. I think Americans tend to confuse a class society with a caste society. And if there's any mobility, we throw the whole idea of class out the door. And that's certainly not what a class society is. It's not that mobility can't happen. It's just the likelihood of it happening is very, very rare. And so these types of stories are not counter to a system of inequality. Mm-hmm. In fact, if we didn't have them, there would be probably some widespread protest and rebellion. But the fact remains that stories like his are rare.
So you write that hiring decisions that appear on the surface to be based only on individual merit are subtly yet powerfully shaped by applicants' socioeconomic backgrounds. How does that happen?
So it happens through a couple of different things. And the main point is that the way that employers define merit, what it is, who has it, they use qualities that are correlated with both parental income and parental education, because class has both an economic component, an educational component, a cultural component, and so forth. So the first thing, as we mentioned before, is that they systematically exclude people who don't attend one of a series of very, very top universities. These universities tend to be some of the least economically diverse in the U.S. and also the least racially diverse in the U.S. But on top of that, they perform additional screens in resumes, resume screening, and in interviews, again, looking for qualities that on their surface appear to be neutral, but the way that they're actually defined and evaluated in practice require large investments of time, money, energy, and cultural know-how, not only by applicants, but their parents. These include things like extracurricular activities, again, privileging those driven by passion and personal interest.
Like what? That's a broad term. What sort of extracurricular activities did you find?
So the ones that are universally valued tend to be participation in varsity athletics while you're an undergraduate at an elite school. That was across the industries, that was universally valued. Some industries, there were more refined ideas of what types of sports, even within the broad category of varsity athletics, that they privileged. This was most strong in banking, where things like lacrosse, squash, very upper-class sports were the norm.
Is that prejudice or malice, or are they sorting for... factors, understanding teamwork or competitiveness that may create a benefit for their company. I mean, I'm looking here at a recent headline saying even high school athletes make more money than the general run of the mill.
Yeah, so I don't think much of this is driven by malice or actually intent. It's happening under the surface.
Okay.
What you do is you have people who are using definitions of merit that are deeply entrenched in upper middle class and upper class ways of being. The idea that you should cultivate your extracurricular life just as you should your educational life or your occupational life is a very privileged way of seeing the world. And when you look at differences between low-income students and more affluent students, whether it's before the point of college or after while they're enrolled in college, there are striking differences. And there are lots of other ways to measure whether or not someone is driven, whether or not they have time management, other than whether or not they're able to... they're recruited on a varsity into a varsity position at Harvard or Princeton. So I think part of it is having a very narrow definition of where you can look to find ambition, intelligence, and so forth. And the places that these firms tend to look most for those qualities tend to be extremely, extremely segregated and limited to people from more affluent backgrounds.
Surely being a jock isn't the only screen. They must know they need more diversity than that.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. It depends on the firm and it depends on your specific resume screener or interviewer. But things like journalism, if you are deeply involved in your school's newspaper, that can be, depending on the evaluator, of course, a signal of some of these things. If you're paired with someone who appreciates the value of the arts, intensive participation in theater can be a good thing. If you're paired with a jock, you might be out of luck because a lot of this is also very idiosyncratic and dependent upon who happens to be screening your resume that day or who happens to be in the interview room with you.
Is it a comfort level thing that people want to hire people they'll feel comfortable with at the club or the golf course or the yacht? I don't know.
I think it's three things. I think one is the comfort factor, of course. People just naturally want to be around people who make them feel at ease. And there is a job-relevant aspect to this in that their work is highly team-intensive and highly client-intensive, and you want to be able to make clients feel comfortable, you want to make your coworkers feel comfortable, and so forth. But beyond that, I think that we have a tendency as humans to define merit in our own image. So there are some great psych studies done on this, but if you ask someone what type of driver is a good driver or a good parent, chances are they will tell you exactly what type of driver or parent they are. And so we tend to define merit in our own image. And when interviewers are allowed to strong levels of discretion in who they hire or even how to evaluate a candidate, a lot of what you get is interviewers picking people not only for whom those whom they feel comfortable with, but those who resemble them personally, who they share experiences. And then on top of that, there's this issue of cultural fit. There's a strong notion in these workplaces and in many others others that workers should not only be collegial or socially skilled, they should really, really be cohesive and have fun together and be able to be friends. And similarity is a huge basis of liking and a huge basis of friendship. And it's no different when people select new hires. They approach it in a manner very, very similar to how they choose friends.
But how narrow is that? I remember a whole spate of stories in the last decade on how Wall Street in its heyday was spending all of their time at strip clubs away from work. That doesn't seem to be a very elite screen.
No, and that, I think that type of behavior has been, is lessened, definitely, in the finance industry. I'm sure it still persists in some corners of it, but it's not commonplace at all. But this idea that work should be play is somewhat that it's mm-hmm. something that's new, and that the best coworkers are not only people who will do their jobs well or who will be civil or who will be polite, but those who you can imagine having lifelong friendships with. I think that's a very new thing.
Lauren Rivera is author of Pedigree, How Elite Students Get Elite Jobs, joins us from Chicago. Lauren, call is for you. Jake in Auburn, Alabama. Jake, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Lauren.
Hi.
Hi.
I just have a comment and a question.
Yes.
I went to school in the South and went to school with two children of very affluent families, very connected families. One who's a big-time lawyer up in the D.C. area, and the other one is a state representative in Georgia.
Okay.
Both were able to be placed in very, very good jobs after graduate or undergrad, and one was able to get into a very fine law school in spite of a very poor GPA.
Okay.
I was, of course, you know, I think that some of these spots should go to kids more deserving who have worked harder and who, you know, possibly have more to offer society. And I was wondering what someone like me, who comes from a middle-class working family, could do to even get my foot in the door.
It's a great question, Jake. Lauren, what do you say?
Yeah, it is actually, it's hard. So it depends, again, on what field you're looking to enter. But if in the legal profession, one of the best things you can do is have an insider connection into one of these firms, which is a catch-22, because oftentimes, if you grew up in a solidly middle-class household, you may not have a friend or a colleague who works directly at the type of firm that you want to work for. One strategy that some people use is that they mine alumni lists for anyone who may share their alma mater, who happens to work in a firm or in an industry. Because law firms tend to look at a very exclusive set of law schools, that can be a challenge if you didn't go to a top-tier law school. But generally, if you look hard enough through alumni lists, you can sometimes find someone who did share your alma mater, and those individuals who come from less prestigious schools, regardless of their own socioeconomic backgrounds, who work in law firms, oftentimes want to help someone from their school out. So that's the best advice I can offer, which is somewhat sad because I feel like I should be able to offer you more.
What about just ditching this realm that you're focused on and say, well, I'm not going to make my career in investment banks or consulting firms or law firms. There are an awful lot of other opportunities out there.
Definitely. I think that with law, it's very hard because you're trained as a lawyer. You've invested years in tuition and training. And the difference between going to a large law firm in a major city and taking other types of legal employment can be about four times the difference in salary. And that's just in your first year. So there are it's a difference not only of immediate income, but also a style of life, a quality of life, and so forth. And law jobs these days are very, very difficult to get.
Lauren Rivera, standby in Chicago. With us right now from New York is William Goodloe. He's president and CEO of Sponsors for Educational Opportunity, SEO. It's a national nonprofit, helps place college students of color in banking, corporate leadership, law, and more. Served on New York City Mayor Bloomberg's Commission for Economic Opportunity. William Goodloe, thank you very much for joining us today.
You're welcome, Tom. It's my pleasure.
So you hear what Lauren's describing, a kind of a pretty tough hurdle to get over if you don't start out in the right place. Can be done, but tough. What do you see? If people are listening and throwing their hands up and saying it's not going to happen, it's not going to work, are they right? Or is there a way to beat this trend?
Well, there absolutely is, Tom. I mean, it is tough. So I completely agree with Lauren's premise there. At SEO, we've had over 5,000 college students of color go through our internship program. We partner with world-class companies as well as law firms. The approach we take is really working backwards and working closely with our partners to understand where the bar is, what are the standards, and then how do we help prepare students to meet those standards. And there's really two broad categories of standards. There's technical standards, and that can include GPA. It includes knowledge of the industry, passion for the industry in banking and consulting. It would be Excel skills, PowerPoint skills, taking certain classes while in college. And then there is that elusive fit. And it's really distinguishing yourself only by the quality of your work. You're already Black. You're already Hispanic. So that's obvious. So you want to only distinguish yourself by the quality of your work. More and more companies and top firms are moving away from the 2 or 3 hour interview or even a full day interview and moving to a 10-week interview. And that is a summer internship. Typically between junior and senior year of college. If a student does well in that internship, they can earn a full-time offer to come back after they graduate from college.
There's a lot of elite college students compete for those internships. Is the elite college ticket as necessary in your observation as Lauren describes it in her research?
That's where SEO comes in, because most banks or firms, just based on limited resources, are only going to recruit at 10 to 25 colleges, and they're typically elite colleges. SEO, we recruit at over 75 colleges. We receive applications from over 200 colleges. So we introduce them to students that would otherwise be overlooked, that they would have no knowledge of, our partners. And with a mix of some students from so-called elite colleges as well as many other colleges, over the years, we've had over a 75% offer rate for SEO interns. So we've been able to provide a pathway for students who otherwise would not be on the radar of some of these top companies.
William Goodlow, as we're speaking, what about white kids listening who may wonder why color is your focus if many of them, by Lauren Rivera's accounting, get cut out too on this path to the elite rungs?
Well, SEO was founded to really provide opportunities to students who are historically underrepresented based on their ethnic background. More and more banks and other companies realize, especially with the internet and the ability to apply virtually and online, there are resume drops and they're opening up their recruiting because they know that talent is widespread. You know, it's been said that talent is widely distributed but unevenly developed. So we see more of a receptivity to folks from other backgrounds beyond the elite backgrounds that Lauren talks about on the part of many of SEO partners, regardless of ethnic background.
We've got a listener here who writes to your premise, Lauren Rivera, elite students, elite jobs, saying this seems likely and true, but at the same time, our listener writes, I don't think there's necessarily a malicious intent in it. And goes on to say, but I honestly think staying in your comfort zone when it comes to these kind of hiring decisions is highly risky in the long run. It is a diverse world. I mean, we're looking at HSBC, maybe cutting 25,000 jobs, the announcement is, in London today. They want to move things to Asia. The world is in flux, Lauren. Are these top firms really comfortable pulling and drawing from the same pool again and again?
I think that they are. And one of the reasons is that they are really looking for the best, but they have blinders on when it comes to what merit is and what talent is and where you can find it. And so the trade-offs between, again, diversity of various sorts and efficiency or what they would call quality, that's a perceived trade-off that they think they have to make if they have to change their hiring practices, which is not a viewpoint I agree with. I think there are lots of other ways to maintain or even increase the quality of the talent pool while having more equitable hiring processes and screens. But I think one of the things that's really interesting is that you mentioned the pace of global change and is this really the best way to do things? There's actually some research to suggest that students from the most elite backgrounds, whether you define that by social class or you define that by educational institutions, are actually worse fits with the actual job requirements of these jobs. So they tend to be more miserable on the job. They are very demanding jobs. They're, you know, not everyone is super happy working at as a new hire in a bank, consulting firm, or a law firm, but they tend to be more miserable than students from less prestigious backgrounds and want to leave sooner.
William Goodlow, we just have a few seconds here, but do you think it's changing? Are companies getting the message they need to be more diverse in who they hire?
I do think it's changing, Tom. Companies realize that there really is a war for talent, and diverse teams make good business sense. Better decisions are made by people from different backgrounds, different perspectives, and there's also a healthy amount of skepticism. There's less groupthink when you have a diverse team, and we've had over 10,000 SEO students go through our program and are now alumni, and more than 100 at most major investment banks are alums, so I think it is changing.
William Goodloe with Sponsors for Educational Opportunity, President and CEO there. Thank you so much. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about who gets the top jobs in America and why, looking at the prejudices and networks and systems and talents that influence who ends up at the top, at least in three arenas. Lauren Rivera's research looks at investment banking, looks at consulting firms, looks at law firms. That is not the entire universe, and she gets it. We get it. But it is a big piece of high income and power in this country. And she finds in her new book that there's a kind of pipeline, and it's a bit narrow. The book is Pedigree, How Elite Students Get Elite Jobs. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Here's how elite employer thinks about hiring. This is Mark Zuckerberg, co-founder, CEO of Facebook, in March, delivering the keynote address at the Mobile World Congress in Barcelona in Spain. During his speech, Zuckerberg talked about his hiring criteria.
So I've developed over time a simple rule, which is that I will only hire someone to work directly for me if I would work for that person.
Okay, simple rule from Mark Zuckerberg. Only hire somebody that you'd want to work for, well, I'm not sure which way that would take us. Jay in Tampa, Florida. Jay, thank you for calling. You're on with Lauren Rivera.
Hi, Tom and Lauren. As an African-American, I have found, I guess, in my anecdotal experience, but also in some studies, that names make a big difference. Even when the resumes were identical, an African-American or ethnic-sounding name was less likely to even get a call back for an interview. I also wanted to say that diversity is shown to have a profit incentive, that more diverse companies are more profitable because they have better ideas and more creative thinking.
The name itself, Jay, what do you make of the story of this Nigerian immigrant who got into all 8 Ivy League schools, Harold Ikei? That's a kind of maybe an African-sounding name. It was not an impediment for him.
Well, I think it's a testament to the point you made earlier that there are folks who can get outside of the trend.
Yeah.
But but also getting into college is also very different from getting into the right job.
Ultimately, on that side, Jay, thank you very much for that. Lauren Rivera, what about things as simple as ethnic or racial indicators, name or you name it?
Yeah, we know that from the research, what the caller was mentioning, there was a great audit study done to show that individuals who have African-American sounding names are significantly less likely to be called back for a job interview than individuals who have white sounding names. So it's very real. And I also think that employers bring a whole set of racial stereotypes and biases to when they interview candidates who are racially diverse that are often unconscious. Sometimes they are conscious, but further disadvantage the candidates while they're in the interview room.
Penelope in Hull, Massachusetts. Penelope, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Lauren. Thank you. My question is the role of gender. Do elite affluent women who attend these same elite institutions have the same advantages in hiring in these top positions? Have you seen that at all? And I guess going back to what was referred to earlier, that most companies are now international, does the geographic base of a company have an effect? Because I'm a New Englander from one of those elite institutions myself. I moved west, and I found I hire a lot of people and maybe look for different attributes now that I live in the West. Do you see any geographic differences as well?
That's interesting. If maybe different parts of the country aren't wrapped so tightly around that axle of elite colleges, Lauren?
Mm-hmm. I think that for the gender question is fascinating. I would say for the most part, women and men who attend the exact same elite schools do have similar job prospects open to them. One of the reasons is that gender is a really easy percentage to benchmark in these schools. So you can easily tell what percent of a graduating class at an elite university is female. Schools don't often do that with race. Sometimes the racial statistics are harder to benchmark. And so that's one reason that if firms are significantly under hiring relative to the percentage of women who are graduating, that can raise alarm bells. But the other thing that's important is that the women who do succeed tend to be those who enjoy more stereotypically masculine extracurricular activities. So these are very athletic women, marathon runners, triathletes, and so forth. These are not stereotypical women. So there's the gender component, but there's also the gender part of gender that is distinctly cultural that matters. In terms of geographic diversity, I think it's fascinating. The industries that I study are very, they do their recruiting often on a national basis. So it's harder for me to parse the effect of geography, but I think it's a fascinating question.
Do you have any sense of whether firms in California or Montana are as prone toward the hiring screens that you describe here as those on the East Coast?
I think that they are prone to them, but they're willing to make more exceptions. So when you look at a consulting firm, for example, and you're looking at the Los Angeles office, they are simply farther away from a lot of the nationally ranked top core and target schools, so that you might find schools like UCLA included on their list of targets, whereas if you're in New York, someone from UCLA is going to have to get in through a connection. Same thing in Texas, very, very similar, that you'll find more students from local Texas schools, partially because you just don't have that concentration of elite universities. But a lot of the same processes are still at play. They just may be a little bit more tempered in terms of the educational prestige part of it.
So maybe it's a little bit of go west, young man, young woman. Martha in Pass Christian, Mississippi. Martha, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I find this really fascinating because I'm the mother of a recently graduated high school senior.
Yes.
And I want to take just like a little step back in this, in that I think another issue or another factor to all this is the fact that for so many high school seniors, especially if they're minority, is that when they go to look for help for deciding on colleges, a lot of times the high school guidance counselors are clueless. You know, if you have a high school counselor that has never, ever done the common application, those kids are not going to even apply to a select school because the counselor is unaware of kind of the process on applying to a top-tier school.
Yeah. Martha, let us pick it up, and that's just one piece of it. I appreciate your call, Martha. Lauren, you write here, children from the nation's most affluent families still monopolize universities. Roughly 80% of individuals born into families in the top quartile of household incomes will obtain bachelor's degrees, while only about 10% of those from the bottom quartile will do so. The relationship between family income and attendance is even stronger at selective colleges and universities. What about Martha's concern?
Yeah, I think it's one of the reasons. It's part of the class biases in admissions. Admissions committees actively look for what they call school quality when evaluating an application. And school quality is measured by several things. It can be measured by test scores. It's also, have you ever sent students to that university in the past, and if so, how many? So there are differences in resources that enable students to go to a Princeton or to go to a Stanford and things like that. When you have 100 people per guidance counselor, it's a very different story than when you have 2 students per guidance counselor, both in the support that people receive, the advice, but also just the customized insider knowledge and access those counselors can provide.
I mean, you remind us that we are kind of set up to do things this way. You're right. The U.S. is one of the few Western industrialized countries where public primary and secondary school funding is based largely on property values. Consequently, high-quality public schools are disproportionately concentrated in geographic areas where property values are highest. Residents tend to be the most affluent. Ledger in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Ledger, you're on. Thank you for calling.
Tom, thanks for having me.
Yes.
My question to the author is, as an African-American or a minority, how do you level that playing field? You know, being qualified for the positions that I see.
Mm-hmm.
I find that a lot has to do with culture, has to do with their interpretation of who I am as a person. Mm-hmm. How do you go about, once you have the skill set that's necessary for a job, how do you go about leveling that playing field?
It's not all abstract, Laura. People are listening, and appropriately, with very concrete dreams in mind. What about
it? Yes. So I think that at the interview phase, one of the stereotypes that can serve as a barrier to racially diversifying firms is that there's a stereotype that certain ethnic groups, in particular black men, as opposed to black women, have worse communication skills. Now, this is not necessarily true, right? But this is a stereotype.
Not true of Ledger, I would point out.
Exactly. But the way that manifests is that I sat in on debriefs and calibration conversations where interviewers had interviewed lots of candidates and they have to talk to an HR rep, and I was that person. And one of the most common criticisms of the black men that we saw in the pool was they were either too formal or too informal in their style of self-presentation. Now, this is totally perceptually based because I saw discussions about white men who had done the same types of behaviors and they were treated as coachable. They weren't thrown out for their communication skills.
But too formal or too informal. That really, that makes up a narrow pass.
It puts people in a bind. But being conscious of the fact that more attention will be placed on your communication skills, even though it's based out of stereotypes and has nothing to do with you, but that's where their attention is going to look for, is this the type of person I want to work with, provided that you have the baseline of skills they're looking for.
It's that culture fit, which can end up being exclusionary, and Lauren Rivera writes, often is. I want to go to the West Coast right now. David Hassel joins us from San Francisco. He's a contributor to TechCrunch. He wrote the essay, Why a Values Fit Matters More Than a Culture Fit. David Hassel, CEO and founder of 15five. It's a company that created employee feedback software, 15five. David Hassel, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
What's the difference between a culture fit screen and a values fit screen? And who's more likely to use a values fit approach?
Great question. Culture fit actually is really important in terms of what you want in your organization is a great culture. The problem is in organizations, when people don't really understand what makes up a great company culture, they default to what they see out in the rest of their lives, and looking for similarities in people who have similar traits.
Mm-hmm. Who looks like them or their friends?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But what you want in a great culture is really people who share underlying common values. For example, in my company, we have a value around health and vitality, for example.
Okay.
Another value around looking for, high leverage in the business. And so, these values can be shared across a variety of cultures out in the world, of a variety of where, people come from different backgrounds and perspectives and whatnot, but still share those underlying values that are key to having a key cohesive team.
Wait, the value that you're looking for is health and vitality. That sounds like you want gym rats with love and respect.
Not necessarily. We look for people who have a commitment to being their best selves, right? So we believe being healthy and vital means you're gonna have great energy coming to work. You're gonna have great energy in your life, and it's something we share in our company. And other ones are we have values around around great communication. One of our values we say is grant trust and be transparent. So we want people who will come to our team and say, look, I'm going to be transparent with each other. And so it's important that you get clear on what those values are for your company and not get caught up, I think, in what Lauren was talking about, in your own unconscious biases when you are interviewing someone for the role, because it's too easy to let those things to fall back on where you feel comfortable, right? So most people feel comfortable around people who, look the same as they do, who speak the same as they do. And if you're not conscious of that, mm-hmm. you can end up making hiring decisions where you have a very homogenous organization. And it's not like you're doing it intentionally, because you can look at all the research. You can look at the research that says, you know, if we have a more diverse workforce, we're going to have different perspectives. We're going to make better decisions. But you can get caught up with your own psychology if you're not careful.
Lauren Rivera, do you see the possibility of a very values-focused hiring process busting up the sort of comfort zone hiring or narrow elite hiring that you're describing?
Yeah, it definitely can happen. I think it requires a very strong idea of what your culture is, and also providing interviewers with systematic metrics so that when they look to gauge a values fit, they have something other than their own emotions and gut feelings to go on. There are companies who do this very successfully, and when cultural fit is done right, it can result in more productive organizations, more employee engagement, and so forth. But the element of knowing what your culture is and systematically defining a cultural fit around the behaviors rather than making broad generalizations about what types of people tend to fit in, whether that's age, whether that's nationality, whether that's a particular type of tie they like to wear and so forth. Tying it to the behaviors that are actually affiliated with thriving in the workplace is what needs to happen.
You can read David Hassel's essay at our website, Why a Values Fit Matters More Than a Culture Fit. He's CEO and founder of 15Five, joining us from San Francisco. David Hassel, good luck and thank you very much for being here.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Tom.
Lauren Rivera, what's it matter? In the end, you devoted a whole book to this. You're concerned about elites reproducing themselves sort of out of the same pool again and again. But for individuals, we understand, if you're not in that stream, it could make for a lot of frustration in a career, in a life, if that's where you want to be. For us as a country, as a society, what's it matter?
Why it matters is that things are, inequality is at an all-time high, and they're going to stay that way unless people try to change the system. And I hope that through writing about these issues, employers as well as individuals realize that a lot of the ideas that we have about merit, about what talent is, who has it, a lot of those ideas are contributing to the strong system of inequality that we see. I do hope that employers will also take a look at this and think, hey, diversity is important, not only diversity in terms of surface-level characteristics and demography, but also people who have different types of experiences. Both make for better teams, more productive organizations. And so I hope that this will spark some sort of desire to actually achieve more of a level playing field that we so often like to talk about having in the U.S., even though the evidence clearly points to the fact that we lag severely behind.
Can it be done? Are there just got a few seconds, but are there efficient ways to look across the whole society of up-and-coming potential hires and find those who are great but not from the cookie cutter you've hired from?
I think they are. There definitely are things that people can do, but it's going to require a change in mindset. And starting with expanding the list of schools that people recruit from and breaking this notion that smart people only reside in one of 10 or 20 universities is really essential to starting that process.
Well, we wish the best of luck and the best shot to all here. Lauren Rivera's book is Pedigree, How Elite Students Get Elite Jobs. Excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. She joins us today from Chicago, teaches at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management. Lauren Rivera, thank you very much for your work here, your insights, your time today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.